Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Atlas Podcast. My name's Alex. I'm joined, as always, by Martin. Hello, Martin.
Hello, Alex. I hope you're feeling a bit better. We've had a little delay because of a few illnesses and things, but we're back on
it. A couple of illnesses. Yeah, as I'm sure everyone is experiencing at the moment, there's viruses popping around from everywhere.
Especially in the Northern Hemisphere.
But we're back, yeah?
They're definitely there. There's more than one of them out there, I think.
Just a few, yeah. Some housekeeping up top. We've got one more full episode left in the year, where we're going to be joined by our new CEO at ATS Global, Kevin Partington. And then we're heading into the Christmas break. So if we don't have a full episode over the new year period, we're probably going to put out a nice best of some interviews and things like that. But yeah, that all details will be coming up soon.
Yep. Thanks, Alex.
Yeah. So for today's episode, we're looking at giant supertankers with a new take on some old technology. We're taking our second look at the Gartner Top Strategic Technology Trends for 2022 report, this time looking at sculpting change. And then finally, we're joined by Aaron Sinner for a fascinating interview, which we recorded a little bit ago, but it's just as fresh and lovely now.
Brilliant. Looking forward to it as always, Alex.
Cool. So, yeah, so this is something you turned up from the appropriately titled New Atlas. This is giant supertanker using 9.8% less fuel thanks to enormous sales.
Yeah. And once you start diving into this subject, it's one of those kind of hidden areas, really. I have been listening to a podcast recently all about what happens on the sea, which is quite frightening, really. But it's a bit of a microcosm of what space travel could be like in the future, I think. But anyway, we won't get too diverted onto the troubles at sea. But it does show you there's this whole world that people we're not aware of necessarily, and maybe it's slightly ignored when we're looking at energy production. But there's over 50,000 of these supertankers floating around the Earth at any one time, as well as all the cruise liners. And you're thinking, that's a lot of ship with a lot of people and a lot of energy. They don't necessarily use the cleanest of fuels to power these great big things. And I mean, they are really powered from the dirtiest diesel fuel possible, really. And so you may have noticed that during COVID, when there were where the cruise liners moored around the shores, they weren't necessarily the cleanest, both from a low level particular point of view and the kind of impact on climate change as well. So this one particularly grabbed my attention, probably for various different reasons. And this one is not. There's quite a lot of stories about sales on supertankers and the future of them and things like this. But this one's actually one that has been launched by the China Merchant Energy Shipping Company. So this is not just a futuristic thing. This is something that's happened now. So
it's not the first time I've heard of this, but they're actually in. They're on the sea now, are they?
So this one was actually launched. And it's got some great, if you see a picture of it, which you will because we look at the link, I mean, there seems like there's plenty of room on this ship for more of these sails, but...
yeah.
And some of the artist impressions on other websites show some even more inflatable or unfolding sails, and so all kinds of different ones. These are more of your solid aerofoil that has a complete control system around it, so it can knows where the wind and weather's coming from, etc. So it can tilt the aerofoils at the right angles and things like this. And overall, the statistics that they're looking at there, something close to 10% saving on fuel. Some of the other articles are pointing to a pack that could get up to about 25%, which is a huge raise. And that is an aerofoil sail intelligent control system that makes sure that it's in the right phase, and it's actually made of a lightweight corrosive carbon fiber composite, the blades. So, as light as possible as well. So similar technology to the blades on, for wind generation type of thing.
I was going to ask, there can be some
huge savings here. So talk about 10%, which is the equivalent of nearly 3,000 tons of carbon dioxide emissions saved every trip. But that does mean enormous. Today, there's 90% still being produced.
Yes. And obviously you want to get that figure down as much as possible. But I guess it's you start with what's good and then go to what's best. So, yeah, the fact that it's saving 10%, if you can get these deployed on all of those, I hadn't realized the number was quite so high, 50,000 tankers, that's still a significant saving in terms of, energy reduction.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, they're incredible things. I would love to see, as you said, there's some concept art of, they look like something out of Blade Runner. You know, they almost like, it's a mix of something from the 14th century and something from the 24th century. So I'm looking forward to those. But still, yeah, for what looks like, obviously, it's a big undertaking to install these things. But I think, yeah, relatively simple to introduce, and for a 10% savings, it not only encourages green initiatives, but I imagine companies that run these ships would be encouraged to do it as well, because it'll save money if they're using less fuel.
Yeah, and I think that return on investment thing is an important aspect, obviously, but we do have to remember, and we've talked about it before, externalized costs as well. So, you know, the diesel fuel is cheap because it doesn't really build into the externalized cost of having that type of fuel, and the impact in the environment and the particulates and on the health of people and things like this, and the impact on the ocean. So it is, you know, diesel is at the price it is because it doesn't take into account these externalized costs. So there would be a far better return on investment case if externalized costs were taken into account, but we are where we are. And therefore, if it's worth doing without considering those things, then even better. But I'd like to see more of that. I think there's also some articles about fuel cell, the hydrogen fuel cell. I think that's another aspect that comes into the picture at some point. And we haven't done much on hydrogen fuel cells. We have talked about them in the past. There are some issues about how you generate the hydrogen in the first place. But if you were generating the hydrogen using a small module reactor and then powering these things with the hydrogen, then we're into another game changer completely as well. So there's definitely some steps in the right direction. It's not as if the technology's not out there. I said sailboats have been around for
just a bit. Yeah.
So, it feels like a no-brainer in some regards, but it does have some intelligent control systems that go with it, keep it on track. But interesting.
And like you say, there's no silver bullet for any of these things. So if you can take 10% off with that and 20% off with something else and a move to electric for certain systems, then you start getting real significant energy savings and a reduction in carbon footprint by doing lots of different things that take a bit off each in their own way.
And I think we have the technologies there. It's more a case at the moment of applying those technologies, not trying to invent necessarily new technologies. That can happen in the background. This is a case in point, really.
Fascinating stuff. Well, yeah, as always, we'll put the links up in the episode description so people can check out the images and words themselves. For the tech spot, people cast their minds back to the last episode. We were discussing this Gartner report. Previously, we spoke about, I think it was Engineering Trust, which had a few different topics within it. This time, we're moving on to Sculpting Change, so where we talk about that people, process, technology sort of idea. This would be, I guess, somewhere between the people and the process. It's the technologies that help you create the change that you want within your business/industry.
Absolutely, we're sculpting change. We've been doing an epic series on digital transformation. And we're one away from the end. I think we've come on to some other things around the subject, around how you can measure digital transformation as well as a part of it. Yeah, so sculpting change is, in the Gartner reports, made up of these, as I call them, compostable applications. But apparently that's not what they're called, is it, Alex?
Unfortunately not, no. Composable applications, though I'm dead keen on just getting our developers working on a compostable application, because there's got to be something green in there.
Decision intelligence, hyper automation, and AI engineering are the four things covered, which is really in our sweet spot, really, because these new technologies and these platform, cloud native platforms, and even the discussion around what is SaaS and what is PaaS, and the latest Gartner hype curve talks about these kind of, you know, PaaS as a service or things like this, or PaaS as SaaS, because this is really the world we're talking about, because you've got to build a platform first, a PaaS, for which you can build the SaaS on. And then you have this kind of thing about a composable application, which is a conglomeration of things. So it's like the fundamental building blocks that you can reformat to create something new. And that requires, in our terminology, a platform for which you can make those applications and build those applications. Those things could be made up of APIs, they could be made up of processes, they could be made up of tasks, they could be made up of dashboards, they could be made up of data bots and things like this. And then you bring them together to try and solve a particular problem. And then you might break them apart again or reform some of them to solve a different problem. So that kind of agility about how you use these platforms to bring things together. Software definable business objects, it talks about, as well as this kind of idea of packaging these kind of business capabilities to solve the problem, is an interesting concept, really, and something we've been working on, because what is an application in the future when you have it in a platform? Well, it's a collection of these things to solve a problem. And once you solve the problem, maybe you don't need it anymore. Maybe you do, because you're going to run the business with it. But it gives you far more agility about how you use your IT systems, and another great power of cloud computing, really, that kind of concept. And then built into that, you know, decision intelligence, really using those kind of agile ways. Like I said, elements of it can be of that complete application, can be your decision making. And when we talk about decision making in this way, it's about how if we look at how organizations are constructed. There's a lot of, you know, middle management that are making decisions, and we talk about bots taking over the world. Well, there's a part of this in this, isn't there? How do you allow bots to make decisions that humans make today within that kind of middle management sector? Or supporting the decision so we can make those decisions faster. And that's kind of what some people think is the best combination, is providing the right information for people to make decisions upon, rather than necessarily having an autonomous decision-making aspect.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just not about decisions for things like robotics or welding processes. It's also about how we fundamentally run our businesses and society, as we see in social media. A lot of decisions are being made for us in social media these days. Which comes on to that.
I was going to say, on decision intelligence, it's that thing that I understand the fear behind it, because you see things being automated and going into the bot world, but actually our focus has always been, and I think thinking back to like conversations with Brett King as well about this, the technology should support the human rather than replace the human. So in things like the legal profession, they use AI a lot because a bot can read 10,000 documents very quickly and then provide the human the information they need to do their job better, basically.
Mm. Yeah, but there will be impacts ultimately, and then that comes on to how do you fund society in the future? which is a similar one where they talk about hyper automation, which they've put under this whole robot process automation, low-code platforms. We call it intelligent business process management. You know, there's many different terminologies out there for that describe hyper automation, and it's really taking those business processes with and automating those business processes, of which within those processes are your decision making points, really. And there's quite a lot in this area, and it changes actually how we use applications in the future. If you've got hyper automation with decision making processes, it cuts across businesses and business structures, as we talked about with the digital transformation. We've built silos within businesses, and those silos have bought applications to do their job. But that means they don't reach outside of the silos. With hyper automation, we will have end-to-end processes, so hire to retire processes, order to cash processes. These things will cut through organizations, and they will be
proper, very much proper PLM processes as well.
If PLM process, if you look at that, if you think about feeding the requirements into an AI bot and out comes the design for your next car, or your, you know, that's kind of would really hyper automate the whole process, whether that's going to be possible or not. I know there's some things now where bots are being creating art, writing books. So it wouldn't be impossible for them to start coming up with those kind of designs around that. And we've seen it with protein folding and things like this as well. And as a part of that, the last one is about AI engineering. So this is more about the kind of the best practices around how to do AI, the management of AI, the data ops, the ML ops. So the operations of how to do the engineering and how to actually, the best practices around that as well. So we can all create we can create an AI bot, but how you manage it, control it, upgrade it, requires certain practices to be built to achieve that. So that was really what they're talking about with that sculpting change. So all of these things really would have an impact on businesses if those four things were taken into account.
Would and probably will, because Gartner, they're pretty good at predicting these things, actually. And if they tend to say it, you often see it coming in roughly the time frame they suggest as well. So, between now and 2025, I think we can see a lot of those trends being adopted across industries.
So all of these are pointing, so the compostable applications is 2024. Decision-making intelligence, they talk about 2023. Hyper automation, 2024. And AI engineering, 2025. Well, all of this stuff is happening now. This is about, you know, this is a part of that hype curve we talked about. So you can look at the hype curve, and there might be a lot of hype about it. Then it goes through this trough of delusion and then it comes into the normal working practice of businesses. So some of these have got horizons between 2 and 5 years, and some of these have got horizons between 5 and 10 years. That's another thing to look at, is that kind of the hype curve and where these things live within that hype curve.
Yeah, for sure. All right, well, we will come back to the final section, accelerating growth, in a couple of weeks' time. Timed that nicely by accident. We're rounding this out for the end of the year. That's all about building blocks are established. It's time to focus on technology trends, etc. So in the meantime, let's jump over to our interview with Aaron Sinner. And we'll be back for a little outro shortly. And so, for this interview portion of the Atlas podcast, we are joined by Aaron Sinha, Director of Business Development for Opto22. Thank you so much for joining us, Aaron.
Thank you for having me. Very happy to be here.
Wonderful. Yeah, usually we like to start off with a bit of background. So, if you'd like to tell us how you got into the world of technology and manufacturing, that'd be great.
Yes, I'd love to. it was kind of by accident. So I did my mechanical engineering, and I started work as an engineer in the nuclear power industry. And I did that for 3 years. And, you know, as everyone probably knows, in the U.S., that wasn't a growth industry in the early 90s. So myself, along with probably 500 of my colleagues, got laid off in 1993. And I just took the first job that looked interesting. It was in a nice city and a nice looking company, and I knew nothing about industrial automation or controls or instrumentation. And that's how I got started. I immediately took to it and enjoyed it, and I've been in controls and automation ever since. I've been at a variety of companies, but here at Opto 22 for the last 16, coming on 17 years.
Excellent. So we had a similar start there. I was also in the nuclear industry. I did my apprenticeship there in the nuclear industry there.
Oh, wow.
And so, about the same time, I'd imagine. I think I was one of the last people, or the last years of the apprenticeship there. I think one or two others might have been after. So it was definitely on the decline at that point. I could
definitely sounds like a similar story to my own.
The other, it seems to be on the rise now. We talk about it quite a lot here, mm-hmm. So it's quite interesting to see how it's changed around.
Outside of the U.S., I see there is interest again, and some people consider it a clean energy, and some don't.
Yeah, I think it's still quite a scary term to a lot of people, but as we've discussed, Martin and I previously on the podcast, it does look like in the medium term, probably the cleanest energy we have. So, yeah, we'll see.
You know, another just personal anecdote, the other change that represented for me was to be customer facing. So in my job as an engineer, I was locked in a room and had very little interaction with the outside world, and didn't see, my boss except every few months to give him project updates. And then when I went to the instrumentation company, it was a rep firm, so they repped about 10 different lines, pressure, temperature, flow, but it was an applications engineering position. So I immediately, maybe after a week, got thrust onto, at the time, the phone and the fax and the email, and had to deal with people doing real things with real implications. So that was a good trial by fire, and I learned very fast in the next couple of years. And then it stayed that way ever since. So I've always kind of been customer facing, either in sales or marketing or product management.
And what about that difference between hardware and software? What was that kind of for you? You went from a mechanical background, which is very tactile, maybe a little bit into the systems and more about the systems hardware now. How do you feel about those different worlds?
There was a learning curve there. And actually, in my job as an engineer, I worked mostly with software. I, did thermal hydraulic flow analyses. We were programming in Fortran back then. So I hadn't put my hands on anything real, tactile, as you put it very nicely. So when I got to work at the rep firm with instrumentation, that was a change. I had to learn about 4 to 20 wiring and what a contactor is and what a mag meter is and all that stuff. So, but it was for me. I realized that it was probably a good thing, this change in my life and my career that happened, because it suited me more. I like to, be able to see things, and software is a little, at least coding is abstract for me, but the change to hardware was a perfect fit. So, yeah.
Excellent. Have you got any particular, projects you worked on that were particularly challenging in that area, or is there any memorable ones that you worked on?
Oh, there's been so many over the years, some challenging, some memorable. There've been many memorable ones. I've been involved in projects in water, wastewater, and food and beverage, with the OEM machinery that's supports various industries. So the memorable ones probably are memorable because there's something funny or odd about them. I do, one I did work on when I first got here to Opto was out in Arizona, and it was a meat processing plant. So that was memorable, but I don't want to go into details in that because I couldn't eat or smell a hamburger for about 3 months after that. But there's been a variety. And that's the thing. It's about the customer facing. What I really love, my favorite part, and it's been a little dormant in the past 3 years because of COVID, but is to go into a plant, walk through the facility, and see what's happening and see how things are being made. And that's the beauty of this job, is that I've gotten to see and experience how many, many things are being made, being manufactured. So I'm glad you brought that up because that's my favorite part of the job. And I think we'll be getting a little bit more back to that now as things are open.
Well, I was going to ask, so you mentioned a little bit there, COVID obviously changed the way you operated. Do you think there are any of those changes that will carry forwards, or is it very much getting back to business as usual for you?
I think it'll be a new mix or hybrid. It's still a bit early, but what I'm seeing and what I think is that the typical, you know, field sales engineer who goes out to see customers, I think the customers themselves will invite you when they really need you. And on the flip side, as a customer facing sales engineer or somebody in that regard, or even system integrators, you'll be a little more selective about your visits and your meetings and things like that. So I think it'll be a bit of a change. There'll be a mix of both. I think the days of going out in the field and just making your rounds and, you know, back slapping, as they say, and buying pizza or buying beers just to catch up, it'll be less. Though, I do feel there was some value in that because it'll be interesting to see, you know, the development of relationships and maintenance of relationships. You know, I think there was some merit into, you know, just having a visit, even if there wasn't a particular project. So I think it'll be a mix, is how I feel.
And when you talked about that kind of customer-facing aspect that you enjoyed, what do you believe that, you know, your personality or something inside you that enjoys that customer interaction compared to maybe the people that like doing the programming, you know, the different personalities that come out with that, isn't there?
Yeah, I think I'm a closeted introvert, and to be an extrovert, it takes a little effort, but I do enjoy that part of it. And the part that's really both interesting and also beneficial is when you are face to face and you are in front of the equipment or walking through a production line or a manufacturing facility, the learning, you pick up so much more. I'm a very curious person. So even if we're dealing with this machine over here, I'll ask, hey, what about that process over there? What is that instrument doing? What are we measuring? What are you doing with that? So that part of it is really good to learn about new things, you know, outside of your own scope or outside of your bubble. And that's a part that I really like. And also that the interacting with people, you pick up so much more just in conversation, and maybe after the plant tour at lunch or something like that, even learning about the person themselves, and you get to know each other. So, but yeah, seeing things and being face to face, I really like. I think I pick up more and learn more because I'm always interested in doing that.
For sure.
What about the device world then? Sorry. And what about the device world? You kind of talked about those sensors, and you talked about the world of Fortran, of trying to process that data back in the past. How do you get involved in those discussions? How does it move from the processes in the business to looking at the kind of sensors, actuators, controllers, what they need for this world in their factory?
You know, it runs the spectrum. So, but typically, when we're dealing with somebody who is running a process plant or designing a machine or something, it starts with what they want to accomplish. They know that they want to have the machine operate a certain way. They want to get certain data. They want to visualize that data in a way. And it's our job is customer facing, vendors of automation equipment and controls to connect those dots and try to make the connections between what they want to do, what problem they're trying to solve, helping spec out the proper gear that will do that. And in my mind, it always starts with at the last mile or the edge, as it's now called, you know, what do you want to measure, what do you want to patrol, and then it moves, you know, kind of up the layers. You know, we're an automation company, so we make PLCs and automation systems and edge controllers. So then it goes there, and how that tool will be used to pick up that edge data and what you want to do with it, and then it progresses from there. Visualization would be next, HMI, data, databases, and then in today's world, it often moves even further into higher level systems like ERP. So that's the kind of connection you make. And having, I'm kind of a jack of all trades, master of none. You know, I know a bit or enough to be able to help customers in all three or four of those layers. So that's kind of how it typically goes, or some form of that.
Yeah. And you mentioned you've been with Opto 22 for 16 years, almost 17 years now, and that's a long time in terms of technology advancing. How have you found the technology in your world, and how it applies to your role changing over that period?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting time, you know, starting maybe 5, 6, 10 years ago. I think here at Opto, there is a culture of innovation. And when I first came here, I saw how Opto 22 had a particular, let's call it angle or culture, where even 16 years ago and prior to my coming here in the company's almost 50-year history, from the very beginning, they always had a bend toward IT systems. So even as early as the 90s and the early 2000s, Opto 22 was looking to have industrial control systems play nicely or share data with IT systems or software systems in protocols and data formats that those systems understand. So they were kind of innovative in this OT-IT bridge back when maybe it was called M2M or something like that in the early 2000s. So I've seen here that progression, and even in the industry as a whole, probably for, you know, 3 decades or something, there were incremental changes in technology. But as we know, in the past several years, there has been kind of a hockey puck or hockey stick change, kind of a more of a paradigm shift in the industry. So I think it's a good time with digital transformation and IoT, where there's significant advancements in some of those older or more traditional norms of what a PLC should be, what an IT system should be. Those are being broken and things are merging together. So here, so long story short, or long answer short, is, you know, coming to Opto 22, I always saw them kind of pushing the envelope toward more IT-friendly control systems, and I think that's now reflected in the industry as a whole. So it's an exciting time. It's only going to, you know, this is a good time to be in our industry. I have two sons, and one of them is coming into this world. He's doing industrial engineering, and he's just finishing up and thinking about coming into manufacturing. And I told him, it's a good time for you. I don't know if I would have said that 20 years ago, but it's a good time because there's such a focus from all sides, people who never even thought of our industry before. It was just kind of in the background doing its thing, and we buy products and we use things that are manufactured. But when you started 10 years ago to see companies like AWS or IBM or, you know, Microsoft start to focus, all of a sudden their websites were showing production lines and automotive assembly lines. I'm like, but, you know, so the industry has turned their focus, you know, with the present situation, the global supply chain crisis, there's a focus on our industry. So it's a good time to be in it, I think.
Absolutely. So you talked about IoT or industrial IoT. Mm-hmm. What does that mean to you with that kind of focus? Because I guess a traditional PLC world, as we can see, is all about inputs, outputs, closed systems, with a program scanning, and you know, people we've talked about before, not many people know what a programmable logic controller is because they're always hidden behind, and people know what a PC is, but what we're seeing a lot of is PCs being integrated into PLC worlds as well. So how would you, if someone asked you, I don't know, maybe you're on a plane and you're flying off somewhere, what IoT is, how would you go about explaining it to people?
Yeah, so IoT and Industry 4.0, digital transformation, all similar terms for the same thing, is a bit abstract. And, you know, I'm sure my perception of it may not be anything that you haven't heard already or your listeners haven't heard. But I've thought about it a lot. And I would say that, and I started thinking about it, you know, probably in about 2015 or 2016 when Opto 22 was taking a focus toward it. You know, what is it? So to me, my first impression was, okay, monitoring factories, processes, machines, getting that data, being able to visualize that data, being able to make actionable decisions off that data. We're already doing that. That's the world of industrial automation since the 1980s. So what's different? So what's different, I think, is, and I'm going to use some of the same cliches or tropes that you may have heard before, but I do think that the difference now is that getting that data into higher level systems or business systems for the purpose of more efficient operations, higher level business systems. Now, I think that that was always or often done, but it was done with difficulty. So if you had to use a common term, siloed data in a production facility through PLCs and through HMI, there was times that data could be brought over to business systems, into ERP or MES, sometimes manually and sometimes with great difficulty and middleware. So what I'm getting to is the difference now is that I think that data, to use a term our VP of product strategy, Benson Hoagland, uses, is that data is more democratized. So it's more accessible. It's in the format that these other systems can understand, and it's moved in protocols or methodologies that they can understand. So I think IoT and digital transformation is basically getting that plant floor, machine floor data into business systems more easily for the purpose of things like efficiencies, cost reduction, sustainability, et cetera. So again, I wish I could give you something that you haven't heard before, but that's probably similar to what you've heard before on your list.
Yeah, but the hardware itself's had to change to adapt to that, hasn't it? I think it's like the IT world is saying I'm the IT world, and the OT world has kind of had to adopt and adapt to what the requirements are from a security point of view, from a protocol point of view, you know. So that has meant, like you said, there's changes that have happened into the in the hardware that you provide because of the demands of this great big IT world that's expecting you just to comply to its rules rather than the other way around.
Martin, you bring up a very good point, and it's a good segue to build on what you said. Is what we're seeing now and what we've done at Opto 22 is essentially kind of mashed together what would be considered a control system or a PLC and more of an IT-like device. So in our current generation platform called the Groove Epic, and that's we call it, made up an acronym, Edge Programmable Industrial Controller. So at the very basic level, it is a PLC, but it's also an edge computer. So it's a Linux OS where you can do processing of that data at the edge using onboard tools, using the Linux shell if you chose. It's also a gateway. So whereas you might have had a separate box to be a VPN, or you might have had a separate box to do some protocol translation, do things like MQTT, does that as well as has a built-in HMI, or I'll call it a GUI, all in one platform. So your point is totally valid and very true that people or companies like Opto 22 are seeing the need to kind of reduce the number of pieces and parts in terms of hardware and software and consolidate them into more of a IT, OT, hybrid product. So that's definitely what's a trend that I think is going to continue.
Fascinating. I can see, as always, we're rapidly bumping up against time. We always get caught up in these conversations. We've talked a lot about the technology there. Is there anything that's coming up over the horizon that you're finding particularly exciting, whether that's coming from Opto or just in the manufacturing sphere in general? What's catching your eye, perhaps just up to the horizon or maybe just over it?
What's exciting to me is, I think where the excitement lies is in the data and what can be done with that data. And what's exciting to me is this movement toward getting plant floor and machine data into higher level systems that can do things like machine learning and artificial intelligence. I think that's where I'm keeping my eye on that space. And I must say, I do a lot of Googling and searching to find case studies of good examples where we can see that something like ML on multivariable data has been used to achieve some business benefit. And it's still early. There's a lot of case studies out there where the end result is talked about, but I'm really interested in the mechanics of the middle, like, you know, how we took, multiple variables from a process, and we put them into a model, and we're able to, you know, have some outcome of prediction where some business benefit could be realized. So that's what's exciting to me. And I think some of the big companies, like the ones, you know, that are household names, like AWS and Azure, they're going that way. So that, I think, I'm keeping my eye on, and I think that's where things are going, and it's very exciting to me. Data fascinates me, and I think that this that's a big part of digital transformation, and will be interesting to see where that goes.
Yeah, couldn't agree more.
Good stuff.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us, Aaron. That was fascinating, and we hope to speak to you again soon.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
That's it for another episode of the Atlas Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me, Martin.
Thank you, Alex. A joy as always. And yeah, it feels like we're sliding into the end of the year in the same way as we slid into the start of the podcast, without necessarily a huge plan, but a joyous exploration of the world of podcasting and technology.
100%.
Long may it
continue. So we'll have to decide. Yeah, one more episode left in the year. Are we going to come back with, are we going to call it season 3? Are we going to continue with season 2? I don't know. That's a conversation for another day.
I would require a plan, wouldn't I, Alex?
We're agile here, aren't we? But yeah. Wonderful. All right, I will see you next time.
Cheers, bye.
For more information on Atlas and the projects we're involved in, head over to weareatlas.com. And to keep up to date with us, follow us on Twitter and Instagram at ats_atlas and on LinkedIn at ats-atlas.